Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. My name is Diane Herriott, and I'm the Parliamentary Librarian, and it's my pleasure to welcome you today to this afternoon's special Parliamentary Library Lecture. Before I go further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians on the land of which we're meeting today, and to pay my respects to their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and of the region. I'd also like to acknowledge and welcome other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who may be attending today's event or indeed listening to it later on the parliamentary broadcast. Today's lecture is part of a long-standing program of parliamentary lectures and seminars organised by the Library for the benefit of senators and members. The aim of the program, which has been running since 1986, is to bring notable speakers to the Parliament to give senators and members and their staff the opportunity to hear firsthand expert opinions on a range of currently relevant topics. Normally we do this back of house, but today's lecture I think marks two important milestones: Reconciliation Week and the centenary of the outbreak of the First World War. Reconciliation Week is, of course, an annual event which commemorates two important milestones in Australia's journey to reconciliation: the anniversaries of the 1967 referendum and the 1992 High Court decision in Mabo, which paved the way for native title. And, of course, this year has seen already the start of a program of commemorations around Australia and internationally, marking the centenary of the First World War. In Australia, we have long recognised the significance of the First World War and the iconic Gallipoli and Western Front campaigns in our history. But it is only much more recently that we have become to acknowledge the role that Aboriginal soldiers have played in these events. We're not quite sure how many Indigenous Australians fought in the First World War because of the nature of the records, and Gary will correct me if I'm wrong there, but at least 400. Figures vary, at least many more. Though many who tried to enlist were, of course, rejected on the grounds of race. And some of these soldiers were decorated for outstanding actions in the field. Reconciliation Week is therefore a fitting opportunity for us to begin to explore this history with Gary Oakley, who's the Indigenous Liaison Officer at the Australia War Memorial. Gary's connection with the Defence Forces is long-standing, having begun as a member of the Cadet Corps at high school, as so many did, and later had a career in the Royal Australian Navy before going on to more curatorial duties, it would be fair to say. I would invite you, therefore, to join me in welcoming our speaker. And I should actually note that you're the, I'm sorry, I've been delinquent, that I should have noted you're also the National President of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Veterans and Services Association of Australia. And clearly I should practice my allocution more precisely before I do this. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I too would like to pay my respects to the traditional owners of this land, their elders past and present, and any elders that are here today. My name is Gary Oakley. My people are the Gundungurra. I'm from the Blue Mountains in New South Wales. So I'm a guest here too. I'll start this slide with the first slide. The AIF judged a man not by his colour but by his worth. That was from a newspaper in West Australia in 1931, and it's a very powerful statement. In the 30s, the RSLs, in the River Valley magazine, actually went looking for Indigenous stories and recognised that Aboriginal servicemen had joined, Aboriginal Australians had joined up to fight in the First World War. The Defence Act of 1903. The Defence Act of 1903 basically said that as we're not citizens and we're not Europeans, we really don't have to join the Australian Defence Force. We, as a people, were not allowed to join the Australian Defence Force officially until 1949. When you read the statement, it actually says it's actually at the discretion of the medical officer, and we'll get into that a little bit deeper later, the reason why it's at the discretion of the medical officer. Why did we join? You know, it's one of those things, you know, why would you join for a country that actually doesn't see you as a citizen? And why would you have to do that, deny your nationality, your aboriginality, your ethnicity? This recruitment, basically recruitment 1914, you know, they thought the war was going to be over in 6 months, we call for recruits, lots of posters went out like this, and you think Indigenous Australians, why would you want to join an outfit that actually doesn't recognise a human being? Well, we've actually never asked anybody. We never did. The history of Indigenous service is a secret history. People don't know anything about it. One of the reasons why was that men who served in the First World War, I always tell people this, the Australian Defence Force, especially the Australian Army, was the first equal opportunity employer of Indigenous Australians. And it was probably the first of government agencies to reconcile with Indigenous Australians, long before reconciliation was around. The reason for this was, even though there was a ruling that said we weren't allowed to join, recruiters usually ignore your colour. You turned up, all they saw was a soldier, all they saw was another guy. You know, he was a man who wants to serve his country. You usually got knocked back later when you went to do your training. Unfortunately, some men thought that to join, they actually had to change their nationality. What is Aboriginality? I mean, through this talk, I'm going to use some terms that are not really nice terms that are not used today, like full blood, half caste, quarter caste, those kind of things. I mean, in those days, we were graded by colour. Today, you're either Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander or you're not. But some men, like this guy, Richard Martin, on his attestation papers, he said he was a New Zealander. He pulled the Maori ticket. And that's what a lot of Indigenous Australians did. If they look like me, I mean, I got my mum's pointy nose, I pass as a Turk, a Southern European, as anybody. I can get by as anything. And what they did was, he thought it might go against him to say that he was Indigenous. He was actually born on Stradbroke Island. He's a Straddy boy. And he denied his birth to join. He actually made it to Gallipoli. He was one of the reinforcements to Gallipoli. He survived Gallipoli. He went on to France and Belgium, was wounded 3 times in France and Belgium, and unfortunately was killed close to the end of the war, and he has no known grave. Charles T. Blackman, on the other hand, joined at the same time when we're not supposed to be joining in 1915. Charles Blackman didn't deny his Aboriginality. He thought he didn't have to, and he had no problems joining. He's an interesting man, Blackman. We hold at the War Memorial very few documentation, very few items on Indigenous service in the First World War. And Blackman's is one of the very few items that we do hold. We have several photographs and postcards he sent back to his family. But also what we have is several letters, and these, up until 6 weeks ago, were the only letters we had from an Indigenous serviceman in the First World War. And he describes his time in London on leave, how he actually finds two little urchins in the street and he looks after them while he's on leave. He feeds them and he writes home to his sister. And he also writes home a letter to talk about what it's like to be in action. And he says, yesterday we captured 5 German prisoners and they had their hands up and someone threw a hand grenade at me, so I killed them all. And he said, from today on, I take no prisoners. I mean, that's the nature of war, but it's quite interesting, his take on it. As I said before, why did they join? One of the reasons we think was pay. They got 6 shillings a day. Now, this is the thing too. When you joined and you got into the army and you put that uniform on, colour went out the window. The Defence Force does not care about what colour you are, what religion you are, where you come from, what your background is. It's all about trusting the man behind you. So you have to trust that guy behind you. So all those prejudices disappear. So when these guys join the army, they actually, were equals. So they were paid as equals. They got 6 shillings a day. 6 bob a day was quite good money when you consider the British Army was getting 6 shillings a week. The Australians were called 6 bob a day tourists. You know, we had lots of money and a good time. The other thing too was possibly he could send that money home. The unfortunate thing about that was that if you lived in a community, usually your letters went through the local post office into the community, say like Cherbourg. Your letters, your money was actually taken by the state agency that ran that community and they took your money. And I've seen some horrible letters attached to guys' service records where the wife's saying, we're starving, where's the money you're sending home? And he's saying, but I'm sending my pay home. Why isn't it getting to you? If you lived outside of a community, you got a better chance of your money getting to your family. The other thing is too, there would have been an element of propaganda, because if you came from a community, you would have been educated by probably a church group who would have said you have a duty, you know, to fight for the old country and et cetera, et cetera. And the other thing too is I think you thought you might be thought of differently when you came back to Australia after the war. After, you know, after all, you fought for the nation, you know, and I'm worthy of being recognised as a citizen. And the other one is country. Might not have necessarily been fighting for Australia, but I'm fighting for country. So, but unfortunately, we never asked anybody. As I said, this is a secret history. The reason for that is men went home, back to community. They were not allowed to march on Anzac Day. They couldn't do the things that average veterans could do. So it skewed the public perception of how many of us served. People just didn't know. And after the First World War, the last thing you want to do is draw attention to yourself in a community. You know, if you start causing trouble, the government's going to cause trouble from you. They're going to maybe come and take your kids or whatever. So people kept quiet. And that's one of our problems too. We are quiet achievers. We tend to go away and serve, and then we go back to community and we disappear. That's how it skewed the numbers. About 5 or 6 years ago, we thought 400 Aboriginals served in the AIF. I got 1,300 names at the moment. I'm getting more every day. We're working through them, so I can put my hand on my heart and say definitely 1,000 at this moment, and it rises every day. Black faces are popping up in the AIF, so they have to put a ruling out. And basically this ruling is that Aboriginal half-castes, men of Asiatic blood, are not to be enlisted. And this says this applies to all coloured men. Now, Chinese were enlisting, Indigenous Australians were enlisting, other people from other countries are enlisting. It depends where you decided to join up, whether you got in or not. Here's one of the guys that did get in, William Joseph Punch. Punch comes from Goulburn in New South Wales, or he joined in Goulburn, New South Wales. There was a story around Punch that he was taken in as a young baby, as a small boy, by a family in Goulburn, and they spread the story that he was saved from a punitive action in Queensland where his parents were killed. I've just found out recently it was not true. He was actually saved from an action in New South Wales, a massacre in New South Wales. The people who took him in lied because they didn't want people to know that he'd survived it. So Punch was well educated. He's apparently a very accomplished musician, and in the Ravelli magazine, they wrote about him that Bill Punch of Goulburn, who was admired by all his comrades and regarded as a dinkum digger. It's funny, sometimes you read some of these things and they say he might have been Aboriginal, but he was white inside. You know, they tend to sort of try to hedge in between the worlds. But there you go. Here's a man that joined when that ruling said he wasn't allowed to join. Nobody paid any attention to it. Another guy, George Combo. George Combo, he's from Collarenbri in New South Wales. Again, he was a guy that enlisted when he was not supposed to enlist. He was wounded twice. He survived the war. There is another Combo that I like to talk about, his name was Benjamin Combo. He was from Queensland. He came out of Cherbourg. Now, you think at this period of time, as an Aboriginal man, you can't travel on the roads, you can't do anything, you can't actually leave your settlement, your community. George Combo, pops up in Bendigo in Victoria and tries to join. And the commanding officer of Bendigo Depot sends a letter to Army headquarters in Melbourne, and it says, "A recruit, Benjamin Combo, a Queensland half-caste, has been sent to this camp from Bendigo Recruiting Depot. He is very dark for a half-caste. Is it correct to enlist him?" They actually then said, no, discharge him. So he was discharged, not being of direct European descent. It didn't deter George. He just went down the road a little bit further, jumped the border to Albury and joined in Albury. But unfortunately for him, he died of disease on the way over to France. Things are changing. There's an instruction now out for recruiting officers that you can actually take in Indigenous Australians. But yeah, the recruiter or the person taking you in has to be mindful of, you have to be a half-caste and you have to have at least worked or lived with white people, because there may be a problem with the soldiers who you have to serve with, may have problems with you being Indigenous. Funny thing is, I have never heard a bad word about an Indigenous soldier in any war. They've always got good words. I've only heard of three sort ofs in the First World War. One was Red Saunders' father on the troop ship. Somebody said, "I'm not going to sit at the table with a black bastard," and he got punched in the mouth for his troubles by someone else. So he grew out of that one real quick. And the other two were by Indigenous soldiers, and the first people who had a go at them actually were military policemen. And the military police usually are drawn from the police at home. They came with prejudices with Indigenous soldiers. And one of them was about, you can't drink in a bar in Australia, you can't drink in a bar here. And the other one, who I'll actually talk about, this young soldier, was again, I believe, a prejudice brought from home. But for every other person you talk about who served with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, you never hear a bad word. Now, the worry about, you know, if they're going to serve with white guys, how the white guy's going to feel. This bloke in the middle there and his mates don't seem to be too worried about it. He's another full-blood Indigenous guy in a time when he's not supposed to join. We've got about three photos of this guy in our war memorial collection. He's a bit of a character, because this is probably about the most officious-looking photo of him. The other two have got him with his hat, slouch hat on sideways like a pirate, and the other one is he's got a sailor's hat on. So yeah, he's a bit of a character. Come 2017, we need men. Referendums have been knocked back. We need men in the front. So now they're going to say that, yes, if you have one European parent, you're in. Private Douglas Grant. This is purported to be a picture of Douglas Grant. I'm having a bit of a trouble with this photo because I've been given a couple other photos of Dougie Grant, and it's a little hard to tell whether it actually is him or not, but we've always used this as Douglas Grant. Douglas Grant's interesting in the fact that he was knocked back originally in 1917, because, again, he has an interesting story about where he comes from, but he was knocked back in 1917 because he didn't have a European parent. He, again, was another baby who was saved from a punitive action in Queensland by an anthropologist who worked for a museum in New South Wales, a man by the name of Grant. And he was brought up in their family. He was very well educated. He was a very good artist. He spoke with a Scottish accent because the Grants were Scots. And he played the bagpipes. But he got knocked back in 1917, and then he re-enlisted. He went back to re-enlist, and he was taken in under that ruling that you must have one non-Indigenous parent. So, you know, I mean, the rules were broken all the time. They were either adhered to strictly or broken. He was captured at Bullecourt, Second Battle of Bullecourt, and he when the Germans captured him, they didn't know what to do with him because they went, he's Australian, but he's black. What are we going to do with this guy? So they put him in with the Moroccans and all the people from the French from North Africa. And apparently, the story goes that a German officer was touring the prisoner of war camps. He was an anthropologist. The Germans have always done these anthropological studies of people, and they did paintings of the ethnicity of different prisoners in the First World War. They did it for other reasons in the Second World War. But he saw Grant and he knew who he was. He said, oh, he's an Aboriginal, so they put him back with the Australians. And he was renowned for his fierce Australianness. He was fiercely Australian, and he was also the man who looked after their Red Cross parcels, because they said he was one of the most honest men they ever came across. He survived the war, and he went on to work for Lithgow Small Arms Factory. When he died in 1951, he got a state funeral, I think. He was one of the very few Indigenous soldiers that got a state funeral. And he had his own talkback show on the radio, Lithgow, as well. Quite an unusual man. Another prisoner of war, Francis Hawkins. Hawkins was wounded twice in France, and he was captured. Again, he's another man who joins when he's not supposed to be able to join under the certain rules and regulations. He's actually quite interesting in the fact that his brother also joined. His brother was a trooper. His brother was a renowned horsebreaker, was in a remount section. And on his brother's attestation papers, they have a page that tells you where you come from, whatever, what your religion is. His brother put down under the religion Aboriginal. Now, families in the Australian Defence Force. This guy, Jerome Locke, he's a Darug man from the Lower Blue Mountains. The uniform he's in is a colonial uniform for the New South Wales Infantry. We, as a people, have been in uniform serving this nation since the 1860s. The earliest known Indigenous person in uniform is a man named Thomas Bungaline, who was in the Colonial Navy of Victoria in the 1860s. There's a wonderful photograph of him in the Victorian State Archives, this Aboriginal man in his sailor's uniform. This is the other guy that we know was in the Australian Defence Force before 1901, before Federation. Jerome's interesting in the fact that he was an oldish man when the war broke out, and he lied about his age to join. And he passed and he got in, and he went overseas with his eldest son, Olga Locke. They were serving together in the same battalion, and somebody checked up on his age and went, you're too old to be in the army. You'd done 17 months or something in the trenches, and they said, you can't be here, and they sent him home. His son got wounded several times. His son was invalided back to Australia. Jerome, when he got back to Australia, went, okay, then I'm going to lie about my age again, and joins again. And they catch him again. And they basically say to him, this time you can stay in the military, but you can't serve outside of Australia. He's also, his youngest son joins up as well. And his youngest son gets to France 3 days after the armistice. So he was lucky he was out of it. But other family groups, see, this is an interesting thing. You get one guy joins and then he tells his brothers, or he writes a letter to them and says, I'm being treated as an equal. This is a good outfit. This is good to be in. So you get family groups. You get people like the Coe brothers from Cowra. There were five of them all join up one after the other. Bing, 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 bing. You get people like the Dickerson brothers from West Australia. There's two brothers. The second brother joins for a different reason. His older brother joins the 10th Light Horse and goes to Gallipoli, and he's killed at Gallipoli, so his young brother joins the 10th Light Horse to fill the space that his brother filled. I mean, really patriotic stuff, but yeah, it's good stuff, interesting stuff. And you get men like the Rigneys, the Rigney brothers from South Australia, quite famous in South Australia. Both brothers join and both brothers are killed. We always talk about the Anzac legend. You know, you watch the movie Gallipoli, do you see a black face in it? No. You know, and everybody thought, oh, yeah, because we weren't allowed to join, we were not on the first day, you know, we weren't on the landing. Untrue. The Anzac legend, the Gallipoli legend, has a black background to it. I've got the names of 50 Indigenous Australians who were at Gallipoli. One of them was a man named John William Miller. He was killed in action on the 25th of April, 1915, on the landing. He's a Tasmanian. Tasmanians are interested in the fact that everybody thought all Indigenous Australians were dead in Tasmania. This is the thing about Aboriginality, you know, if you can pass as not being Aboriginal, you don't say nothing. And everybody thought, because the Tasmanians, after Truckanini, ceased to exist, which was untrue, Tasmanians had no problem joining up. They had no problems actually in going through the compulsory cadet system and all that, which Indigenous Australians were banned from. So the Tasmanians entered the Defence Force a lot easily in most other states. Now, John Miller, he's killed on the 25th of April. He's last seen jumping out of the boats and heading up the hill, and he disappears. But no one seems to know what happened to him, so it jumps backwards and forwards for days. Where is he? Is he killed in action? Is he lost? Is he a prisoner of war? And this goes on actually for months, and his wife's writing letters saying, where is he? What's happening? I've heard he's been transferred to the 4th Battalion. I've heard this, I've heard that. They can't find out what happens to him. So after months of this backwards and forwards, and by the way, he's got a wife and three children, and she's waiting to have the paper tick to say that he's dead so she can draw a pension. So, you know, she's getting desperate. She wants to know where her husband is, and she wants to know how she can feed her kids. So things are flicking backwards and forwards, and in the end, an army says, we've declared him dead. He's not heard of, and she still writes letters in the 20s, you know. Where's my husband? Where's my husband? He's not heard of until 1921, when they find his body inland. And they write this letter to her saying that due to the nature of his body and how we found him, there's no much personal objects on him, but we've enclosed in this letter his dog tags as a personal keepsake. So he gets buried in 1922, basically, after all. She gets no closure until 1922. Another Gallipoli veteran, Arthur Thomas Walker, South Australian. He survives Gallipoli. He goes on. And this is the thing. A lot of these Indigenous guys, I said 50 of them, 12. I know of 12 who were killed there, or either buried there, or buried somewhere else, or buried at sea. I've got to do a little bit more research on another few guys, so there might be more. But a lot of the men that survived Gallipoli went on to bigger and worser things, especially when you think of Fromelle, most of the 5th Div, not the 8th Brigade, but the other two brigades, the 14th and 15th Brigade, were made up half of Gallipoli veterans and half of new recruits. And they went into Fromelle and got 5,500 casualties in 24 hours. But a lot of these guys, like this fellow Walker, they went on to Pozieres. He survived Pozieres and he gets killed at Mokay Farm. This guy jumped out of the woodwork about a year and a half ago. We always thought Reg Saunders was the first army officer in the Australian Army. Another Tasmanian, 2nd Lieutenant Alfred John Herps. He's a sergeant on Gallipoli. He's a staff sergeant in France. Just before Pozieres, he's promoted to 2nd Lieutenant. He's our first known Indigenous Army officer. He's Indigenous on his mum's side. Again, that ethnicity thing, would he call himself Aboriginal at the time or not? He's at Mokay Farm and he's hit in the neck by shrapnel and paralysed. Just turned 21, I think. His batman stays with him and he says to his batman, run away, run away, go, you know, get the hell out of here. Everything's turning turtle. So his batman races back to headquarters and headquarters, he says, can I get two men to go and get him? And they say, no, Mokay Farm's back in the hands of the Germans. And he's never heard of again. And about 4 months later, his ID discs are handed in by another battalion who find them. He has no known grave either. Now, we touched on before medal winners. When you think, I've got 1,000 to 1,300 names from a group of people who were thought to be 80 to 90,000 Indigenous Australians at the outbreak of the First World War. So I've got just over 1,000 names. So you think 1,000 out of that population, out of that 1,000, at least 120 of them are killed in action, many more wounded. But out of that 1,000 so far, I've got 3 Distinguished Conduct Medal winners. The DCM was 2nd to the Victoria Cross. And about 9 military medal winners, a couple of mentioned in dispatches, and some won foreign awards like Belgian Croix de Guerre and whatever. And I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg. We have not researched everybody yet. This guy's interesting because up until about 2 months ago, we never heard of him. We didn't even know he was Aboriginal. a lady rang up about a year and a half ago and said, oh, I got some medals from the family. I know you're interested in the First World War. The family's decided that we'd like to donate him. He's got some MDC medal or something. And we all went, ooh, DCM. Yeah, we'd be interested. And then when she turned up, she plonked the medals on the table and go, oh, here is your two brothers' medals too. And we went, ooh, interesting. And then she said, oh, here's a paper thing that his mum kept. And we looked at it and they go, that's his mother. And they go, yeah. I said, she's Aboriginal. And she goes, yes, of course, we're Aboriginal. And we went, oh, really? We didn't know about this guy. We never heard of him. So all of a sudden we went from two DCM winners to three. Our medal collection for First World War Indigenous Australians jumped 300%. We had one medal from a split medal group from a guy named Prentice who was a military medal winner as well. We didn't have his military medal. So we were over the moon about it. And then once I got talking to the family, they went, oh, there's a trunk of stuff. You know, I said, do you have photos? They go, oh, yeah, we got some photos. Oh, we got letters. We've got his Bible. We've got... And so we're doing a road trip to go and visit the grannies, the old aunties, and they're going to pull the trunk out for us to have a look at. But, I mean... this is big stuff. That's the only known Distinguished Conduct Medal winner, medal, Indigenous medal, held by anywhere. That's the problem with Aboriginals, Torres Strait Islanders, Aboriginals, especially in the First World War, when they go home to community. They go home to community and they're living in lousy conditions. And you always see on the attestation papers in the 20s, can you send me my discharge paper? It was burnt when my tent burnt down, or the rats ate it, or, you know, something like that. So stuff does not survive. Indigenous soldiers didn't have the opportunity to come home, take their uniform off and hang it in a cupboard like non-Indigenous soldiers did, because guess what? It's a good hat, it's a good jacket, it's a good pair of trousers, a good pair of boots and a greatcoat. I will wear them, you know. So unfortunately, to get something like this is a rarity. Two more MM winners. The reason I mention these two guys, the one on the left is Harry Thorpe, and Reginald Rawlings is on the right. The reason I've mentioned Harry Thorpe is... these two guys. Harry Thorpe, we're also getting Harry Thorpe's headstone to put in our First World War gallery. It has a tiny nick in it, so Wargraves is going to give us his headstone as a focal point, a feature point in the new First World War gallery. Not just because he's Indigenous, it's because it's all about the service and sacrifice of Australians. He just happens to be Aboriginal, and he just happens to be an MM winner. It's a first for Wargraves. They do not normally do that. And the other guy, Rawlins, these are both Victorians. Rawlins, he's interesting because his name, Reg, he's Reg Saunders' uncle, and Reg was named after him. They were both in different battalions. They knew each other. They were the best of mates. They were killed on the same day. They're both MM winners, and they're buried in the same cemetery nearly next to each other. You can't tell the story of Indigenous service in the First World War without mentioning the 11th Light Horse Regiment. Just for interest, the big guy on the right is Catherine Freeman's grandfather. The 11th Light Horse was known as the Queensland Black Watch. For a state that was kind of racist, Queensland has a whole lot of Indigenous soldiers, men joining up. And for some reason too, the Queenslander newspaper that came out through the war, they photographed and put these little tiny thumbnail photos, pages of them, who has joined. And there's Aboriginals in them everywhere. The 11th Light Horse had one reinforcement of 26 men and they were all Aboriginal. The whole reinforcement was Aboriginal. There was like 38 or something in this unit. This unit had the most Indigenous soldiers in one unit than any unit in the First World War, the 11th Light Horse. We're going to use them as a story too at the War Memorial. We're nearly to the end of this. I said I'd tell you a story about the one other person that I knew of who'd got some trouble for being Aboriginal while he was in the Defence Force. While he was in the army, and his name was Private George Robert Aitken. Robert Aitken, we don't know who his father was, but we believe his father was the station hand or station owner, whose last name was Aitken. His mother's name was Princess. she was a local Indigenous lady, as a young boy who was brought up in a white family, the Hampsons. He was brought up with three brothers, a sister and a half-sister, who all saw him as their brother. And when the war broke out, all the brothers volunteered. The older white but non-Indigenous brothers went first, except for one, the youngest brother. They all went overseas. One was killed in action. One was wounded and repatriated. The youngest brother and George joined together as mates. And this is the great thing, this is mateship, you know. I didn't see no colour in this guy, we're just mates, we're going to join the army together. The army didn't see any problem with them, they're just mates who wanted to join. They went overseas together, they trained together, went overseas together. While they're in training in, I think it's Cotsford in the UK, they were on leave, they were in the village and the military police turned up. And they beelined for poor old George. And they basically said, you get out of the village. And as I said before, the Australian military police were most probably drawn from state or whatever police forces. They came with prejudices. He refused to leave. They manhandled him and he thumped the corporal of the military police. He got 2 years hard labour and a year's pay docked from him for punching this guy. The judge advocate went, oh, that might have been a bit stiff, so they gave him a year's hard labour and 50 days' pay. Then after 6 months, they went, oh, we'll let him out and he can go to the front. His brother that he went over with had gone to the front before him and actually been wounded, recovered, went back to the front, was wounded again and was made a POW. So George Aitken basically went to the front without his brother. But he wrote two wills. One will's a government will where you just fill in the blanks. And then he dictated a will to probably the unit clerk. And I'll read it to you. It's actually been taken down how he spoke. So it's punctuation's horrible and the sentences are a bit skew-if. But it's quite an interesting will. And it says, just a little story of our friendship. Well, Dan, I can safely say that we are the only true mates there are in the world. That's a big word to say. Well, Dan, if I gets knocked, you can have anything you find on me that is any use to you, and my allotted money to be left to Mrs. T. Hampson. Show this to one of the heads, don't forget. Goodbye, old man, and good luck to you. Wishing all sorts of luck to pull through this war. We have been the very best of mates, and only thing I wish that we meet over the other side of the world, if there's any such place, is that I don't think I will ever forget you, Dan. I will think of you when I'm dead. Never need to say much to you when we used to knock about together. I was very funny like that. Anybody I liked, never say much to. Goodbye, and old man, good luck. He was killed about 3 weeks later. And his brother didn't know until his brother was actually released from prisoner of war camp. So basically that's it. I'm not going to go into on returning to Australia. You know, we all talk about soldier settlement and all that kind of stuff, so that's another lecture from someone else. There is another letter that I'd like to read, which is kind of interesting because it's actually from the RSL. The RSL on one hand could be the most bastardised unit in the place and stop blokes, Indigenous guys, from being involved, or went out of their road to help them. It doesn't gel. But in 1919, this letter was written to Prime Minister, and it says, Dear Sir, I have been instructed by my executive to forward the following resolution, that this branch of the RSA insists upon the retention of the White Australia policy and that we emphatically protest against any suggested amendments of our Commonwealth Immigration Restriction Act, so vitally necessary for the future of welfare of Australia. Remembering that over 50,000 of our comrades have voluntarily made the supreme sacrifice for this country's liberty and race purity. I guess they forgot that there were a hell of a lot of Indigenous Australians fighting for their country and their race purity. Thanks. On the job.
I would actually like to commend the work of the Australian War Memorial in helping us remove this collective blot on our national memory and put faces and names to people who risked everything and often lost everything, but who have not been part of our national narrative. And it's work such as Gary's which gives a chance for us all to recognise and acknowledge and celebrate the courage and sacrifice of all of our members of the armed forces, just not the ones that have to date featured in our national narratives. Gary has very kindly indicated he'd be happy to try and take questions.
Yeah. Not hard ones.
Or indeed would be very happy to have future leads, I imagine, if anyone has any to make. But I open the floor. There are mics for those who don't have loud projecting voices.
I'd like to also say, just before we start, it's not just my work. There are people in the crowd here who volunteer to help me do this. I'm a team of one with volunteers. So
perhaps we should ask the volunteers to stand so we can applaud them too.
Stand up.
Unwilling standing volunteers.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I really don't have the time to do a hell of a lot of this stuff. I'm just struggling day by day to do Indigenous commemoration stuff. It doesn't exist without people like my volunteers. So, yeah, if you want to volunteer, please feel free. But, yeah, questions?
We might just start with having a mic issue, or are we right?
Yep, there we go. Thanks. Thank you so much, Gary, for a great presentation. A couple of years ago at the Australian War Memorial, we had a presentation called Too Dark for the Light Horse, which I think presented a fairly unbalanced view of what was really happening. Have you had a chance yet to do something about that presentation of a couple of years ago and whether it can be represented with just a few more facts like you've presented today?
Actually, it still travels.
It's
still around. The War Memorial has in its education program, it has a museum in a box type things, and they have one called Too Dark for the Light Horse, which gives a much more balanced view on Indigenous service across from the first day to the present day, and it has case studies. So we do that to schools. When that came out originally, that was the information we had, and it was basically the research work of David Hugginson, and all it was really a bunch of photographs. It really didn't delve into the stories. The new First World War Gallery, when it's opened, we're going to do something that we haven't really done in the other galleries. We're making an Indigenous story more inclusive. If you look at the Second World War Gallery, it's got the Second World War Gallery, and in the corner it's got a couple of captioned things and some paintings, and it's like, oh, and by the way, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders did serve in the Second World War. The First World War Gallery will start from day one, from the Defence Act, from all of that, and will work all the way through with stories interspersed in between of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. We're going to try to do something like we don't draw attention to their ethnicity unless it's a little hard to pick. Because, golly, you know, you don't have to say, oh, this guy's Aboriginal, do you? Because he is. So we're going to try to do it a little bit different and be a lot more inclusive. And I mean, you know, it's like everything. We have to change how we do business. And we only started to know this stuff in the last probably 5 or 6 years. It's been secret history. This is what is good about it. It's fresh. It's new. It's all good stuff. War's not good, but this is all good stuff. And Indigenous Australians want to be heard. I mean, I've got people that say to me, oh, who are your heroes from the First World War? Out of all those Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, you know, pick a couple of heroes. And I go, there's 1,300 of them because they beat the system, you know. So, yeah.
Thank you very much. I found that most interesting. But when you said that the AIF became an equal employment opportunity place, which I thought was brilliant, I do have to ask, were there any Aboriginal women in the army?
No, not in the First World War. But we do know of one Aboriginal woman in the army in the First World War. She was in the Canadian Army. As a nurse. She left Australia. I think she married an American or a Canadian. She left Australia. She trained as a nurse in America and then she joined the Canadian military forces and served overseas in the Canadian Army. So she's the. There is another lady. We have a photograph in the War Memorial at a military hospital in Sydney, and she's dressed in like a nurse's aide uniform with a white uniform and a red cross on the front. But it's just got her labelled as Black Mary. Yeah. So yeah, I know it's. But it's an old photograph caption. But no, we don't know. We don't even know anybody who served in the Royal Australian Navy either in the First World War.
That's going to be my next question.
The Royal Australian Navy, being a sailor, was more pucker than anybody else, and we were ruled by the British. Even through the Second World War, we didn't have our own admirals. We didn't get to do anything. And yet surprisingly, though, the Royal Australian Navy, prior to the Second World War and during the Second World War, employed lots of Indigenous Australians in an auxiliary capacity. There's some wonderful photographs of Snake Bay Patrol, blokes from Tiwi and Bathurst Islands at HMAS Melville in the Second World War. They're all parading in military uniform, naval uniforms, all carrying firearms. They have NCOs, but they're not in the Navy proper. The Navy used on HMAS Geranium during the 1920s, used a lot of Torres Strait Islanders and Tiwi and Bathurst Island men as well, who they dressed as sailors to work with Oceanographic, doing oceanographic surveys. We've got Indigenous naval personnel who were killed serving on ships during the Second World War. The unfortunate thing about them is because they were not in the Defence Force proper, they don't get up on our cloisters on the wall. And that's not just Indigenous Australians. If you look at HMAS Matafili, which was a Burns Phillip ship requisition during the Second World War, it came across with its whole crew of islanders and Torres Strait Islanders and islanders. They all opted to join the RAN. So they put a white crew and an Indigenous crew on the ship. There's a beautiful photograph of them all in their uniforms, all dressed exactly the same. The ship sinks. It's lost at sea with all hands. They don't know how. The unfortunate thing is, on our cloisters at the War Memorial, only the non-Indigenous sailors get a mention. The other half of the crew ceased to exist. So, you know, there are a few little things like that. And the Navy. The Navy's always been a bit pucker about stuff. Yet, when I was in submarines, the submarine squadron, we had 5 Indigenous sailors in the squadron at one time. That's something I want to say too. The Defence Force is like traditional life. You've got tribal groups. You've got Army, Navy and Air Force. You've got 3 tribal groups. Within those tribal groups, you have clan groups. You have gunners and you have air crew and you have submariners and you have all of these other little groups within the traditional groups. Within the tribal groups, you also have totemic symbols like traditional groups. You have flags, guidons, banners. The army trots out goats and eagles, corporal courage, and all that sort of stuff. You know, it's very similar, and it's the same ethic. You all look after each other. You leave no one behind. You all share the same. You all do the same thing, and I think that's what makes the Defence Force comfortable for Indigenous Australians. I'm still a reservist, and I work for DIA, Defence Indigenous Affairs, and we recruit Indigenous kids. And when you talk to some young Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander man or woman who joins the Defence Force today, you go, oh, why did you join? Oh, I want a career, I want this, I want to do that, I want to travel. But Dad was in the Army, and great-granddad was in the Second World War, and great-great-granddad was in the First World War. There is a tradition of service within Indigenous Australia that's quite phenomenal. And I think that's because it's a place Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders have always felt comfortable. Because you walk through the front door, you put that uniform on, colour goes out the window. You've got to trust the bloke behind you. Sorry, I digress.
I think we have time for another question.
Oh, I broke it.
We'll send it.
Thank you. Send it to my boss.
Any further questions?
I just wanted to know that you talked about the story about the widow and the children and how long she had to wait for support. I'm just wondering how that... I know we buy legacy badges and poppies and things like that. Does that include the Indigenous community as well?
Interesting question, because people have always said to me, oh, after the war, you know, Indigenous service personnel didn't get the same... welfare, they didn't get the same rights as other soldiers. Untrue. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander soldiers, Aboriginal soldiers in the First World War had the same rights as any other returned servicemen. Guess what? They went back to community. Nobody bothered to tell them. Nobody went out looking for them, you know. So therefore, it skewed. They never saw marching on Anzac Day. So they went, there's not a community of people out there. We have to go and rattle a chain, you know. So guess what? It didn't happen. We had the same basic rights. I mean, there's another thing people say, oh, you know, we weren't allowed to vote. Yes, we were. Some states said no, but some states were allowed to vote. We're not encouraged to vote. And we can vote in a federal election if we voted in a state election, but we were not encouraged to do it. And sometimes, too, the government just didn't realise how many of these people were out there. On your attestation papers, it doesn't say Aboriginal. It usually only says that if you get booted out for that reason. Sometimes they might write on, oh, half caste, or something like that. But no, you know, all they see, if you applied for a grant or a TPI or TPO or something like that, they pulled your service record. All they saw was your service number, where you served. So colour meant nothing, but no one went and told anybody. That's the problem. It's still a problem today. You know, Vets Affairs has got people out in community. There are little old ladies living in community who haven't realised that they can get a war widow's pension, for God's sake, you know, and their husbands have been dead 20 years. Yeah, it's still a problem. But no, we had rights. That's that?
I think that's that. We may, in fact, I think, revisit, given that we will be commemorating the First World War as it progresses with a series of sort of publications and lectures and events, we may invite the War Memorial back to talk about the other end of the story, or in fact perhaps even the middle. Mm. But I'd like you to join with me, please, and to thank Gary for a very, very excellent presentation.
Thanks. And if you know anybody who was an Indigenous serving member, or you got one in the family, I want his name.
And possibly his trunk.
Yeah, and a picture of him.
Thank you.
Thank you.